Okay, I think we've got everybody. Patty's at the... Here she comes. We'll return to the information items under the executive committee. I have passed around our 2013 meeting schedule. I followed that with a handout on the committee assignments for the upcoming year. If I don't hear an objection, we'll assume that those are okay with the regents. Any discussion or question on those? We'll move to the next information item, the internal audit report. Mr. Irons.
Thank you. All right. Hopefully, all of you have this quarterly report in front of you. There's probably a cover page or two there, but I would move on to the basically there's four schedules that follow that cover page. First one is the prior period page. If you were to think back to the last quarterly report we had, there were several issues that we either unresolved or had parts of the reviews. There were issues that were unresolved. So this I presented them here, and they have been resolved as of this day. So, again, there were various things that were unresolved, and they've been resolved now. There's four items listed there. There's not any questions. I'm just going to move on. Next schedule is the current period schedule. These are reviews that we completed during the most recent quarter, June 30 ending quarter. And again, various things there. High impact, two moderate, one low, and some miscellaneous items. As I recall, I believe all of these items, there were various issues that were raised in these different reviews, and all have been resolved again as of this day. So, or in the process of being resolved. All right. The next page is the current period in progress. These are reviews that we're currently, that we've actually been working, some of these have been working on for some time. But some may have actually started in this last quarter, but these are things that we're currently working on, different types of items that we're currently working on. And you can see probably some of these, you might, if you would look back at the last quarter, you would see some of these obviously are a continuation from the last quarter's report. There may be a couple of items that are actually new on there that we started some additional things during the quarter. So, again, a variety of risk. The first one being high. There's several that are moderate, as I've, and I think I've indicated previously, that in reality, some of those moderates are probably going to end up being high. And also, since I'm talking about this, I should say, I believe all of you did hopefully receive an email from my office where I was asking for input, if there's any areas you were interested in. We actually send that email out or a similar email out to all of the administrative council members and also all the college deans. So, and this year we also, we send it to, this is the first year we actually sent it to you as well. So certainly we're open to anything you might want us to investigate or look at or and I think there was actually a deadline on that, but I mean, obviously, if there's something you're interested in, you just let us know anytime throughout the year, and we can try to work that in. All right, and then the last page is things that we are intending on looking at, future period, things that we're intending on looking at, but have not started as of this day. And some of these things actually are things that various individuals have brought to our attention to or asked us to look at. As a result of that inquiry that I just mentioned. So. Any questions? All right.
Thank you, Warren. Next item is athletics year-end report.
I Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Dr. Ransdell and the board appreciate the opportunity to be in front of you, and certainly appreciate the opportunity to serve as your director of athletics. It's a position that I obviously take very seriously. It's an honor and a privilege to serve in this role, and my assurance to you is that I will approach this with the utmost care and integrity and sincerity to everything that we do on a 365-24-7 basis. What I wanted to do today, I know that you all have the annual report. I thought I would mix things up a little bit rather than read to you a report that you already have. Put together a video. It's about 6.5 minutes that recaps the 2011-12 year for us and also goes through what our goals will be moving forward. And then I have a couple slides that I'll show after that, and then certainly would be happy to take any questions that any of you have. So, Jeff, if you want to... I am Todd Stewart, Western Kentucky University's Director of Athletics. Our athletic department will always strive to be a vital component of both our university and the community in which we reside. We have a rich tradition of success through the dedication and efforts of outstanding coaches and student athletes who practice and play in first-class facilities. And we will always strive for excellence in everything that we do. Throughout the nation, the athletic department often serves as the front porch of the university, and many people's opinion of a university are influenced by their opinion of the athletic department. We take our responsibility seriously, and we will always be mindful of our role in WKU's overall mission. I am proud to say that in 2011-12, we had many notable accomplishments, both on the field of play and in the classroom. Claire Donahue, who graduated in May of 2011, won two gold medals in the 2011 Pan American Games, and then became only the second WKU student athlete ever to earn a spot on the United States Olympic team when she qualified in the 100-meter butterfly at the U.S. Olympic Trials in Omaha this past June. Bobby Rainey, who graduated in December, ranked second in the nation in rushing in 2011 and was named to five separate All-American teams. 2 years ago, when Willie Taggart took over the head coaching position of our football program, he inherited a team with a 20-game losing streak, the longest current losing streak in the nation at that time. But 2 years later, he has completely turned our football program around after guiding the Hilltoppers to a 7-5 record in 2011. And we won 7 of our last 8 games, with the only loss being at then number 1 ranked LSU. Our track program became the first in Sun Belt Conference history to win the league's men's track trifecta by capturing the cross-country, indoor, and outdoor track titles in the same season. Our women's cross-country team also won a Sun Belt title, marking the 18th consecutive track title for the program before that incredible streak ended in February. Our volleyball program won the Sun Belt's regular season and tournament titles, and advanced to the NCAA tournament for the second consecutive season, and have now been to 6 NCAA tournaments under the direction of Travis Hudson. After naming Ray Harper our men's basketball head coach on February 19th, we won 7 consecutive games, despite trailing in the second half of all 7. WKU became only the second team in Sun Belt Conference history to win 4 games in 4 days in claiming the league's tournament title, and then won an NCAA tournament game in record-setting fashion a week later as the 16-point deficit we overcame against Mississippi Valley State marked the largest in the history of the NCAA tournament with less than 5 minutes remaining. We are equally proud of our academic achievements, and all of our student-athletes are able to utilize the 10,000-square-foot Carol and Denny Wedge Student-Athlete Success Center. Following the recently completed spring semester, the average cumulative grade point average of all 385 WKU student athletes is a 3.05, and the average team GPA of 11 of our 15 sport programs is a 3.0 or higher. We also had 120 athletes graduate in the last calendar year, as 46 graduated in WKU's December commencement ceremonies, while 74 additional student athletes earned their diplomas in May. And since the year 2000, 85% of our student-athletes who have fulfilled their eligibility have graduated, further illustrating that we have an outstanding blend of athletic and academic success at WKU. Our success can be traced to many factors, but there is no question it begins at the top. The vision and leadership of our president, Dr. Gary Ransdell, has impacted and transformed our entire university. And we are very fortunate to have a board of regents that shares this commitment to excellence across our campus. Our coaches work tirelessly in recruiting and developing our student athletes, and our athletes are motivated to succeed in all their endeavors. WKU's faculty and staff understand how athletics can support and bring greater attention to the university's overall mission. We receive vital support from our community, alumni, corporate sponsors, and friends, and the loyalty and passion of the Hilltopper Nation is unique and inspiring. Moving forward, our objectives can be classified within the following five areas. First, our student athletes are the reason we are here, and our primary focus will always be on helping them obtain their degree and on providing the important personal development that is necessary to prepare them for life after college. We have won 82 conference championships since the year 2000, 34 more than the next closest Sun Belt Conference school. Our goal will always be to win championships, and we can make an even greater impact on the national stage by succeeding in NCAA postseason play on a repeated basis. We have outstanding fans, but we must expand our fan base, pack our athletic venues on a consistent basis, and grow our revenues. And as revenues rise, so will our ability to increase the investment in our student athletes, programs, and facilities. We must continue to be a vital component of our community by consistently engaging and interacting with our constituents, schools, charities, and youth groups. And we always must understand, monitor, and be compliant with NCAA rules. Our responsibility is to ensure that we not only build upon past accomplishments, but aspire to reach even farther and higher than our predecessors. We will be proactive and aggressive in identifying challenges and overcoming them, and we will never settle as another accomplishment always lies ahead. We will not be influenced by what those outside our program say we can and cannot do. Our opponent is on the field of play and cannot be a fictitious character that resides between our ears. We are the ones in control of our destiny, and with our history, tradition, facilities, and fan support, the sky is the limit for WKU athletics. We don't only have to dream big, we can achieve big, and we will. On behalf of our student athletes, coaches, and staff, thank you for all that you do for WKU athletics, and go Tops!
Great video.
Excellent.
Not bad.
Excellent.
Who are you going to show that to other than us?
Well, since you asked, if I go out and speak, many times I'll play that as an intro to my speech and then open it up to questions rather than just sit and lecture somebody. That way they can see that, and then I can talk about what they want to hear and what they want to talk about. I will also email it out next week to our email list that includes all of our season ticket holders and our Hilltopper Athletic Foundation members, because obviously Wednesday is August 1st and August 6th is the first day of football practice, so that we're right around the corner from 2012 and 2013. I put this together. I'll just touch on a couple quick things that were in here, but I really wanted to make sure that we highlight the things we're really proud of. Certainly the Sun Belt Conference championships. I mean, we have dominated the Sun Belt Conference, and those numbers obviously illustrate that, but not just on the Sun Belt Conference level. You know, if you look nationwide, this is over the last 5 years, and it has each conference and the school within that conference that won the most championships, and only Brigham Young across the nation won more conference championships than we did. So certainly that's something that we're proud of. But like I mentioned in the video, I do think in order for us to take the next step, we've got to do a greater job of succeeding in NCAA tournament play in the postseason. With the exception of men's basketball, our other sports have not had a lot of success on a team basis in the NCAA tournament, and that's what we really need to do in order to take the next step, and I'm confident that we'll be able to do that. Academically, we're very proud of what we've done, and what really makes me the most proud, without reading through every one of these bullet points, but our academic success really encompasses all 19 of our sports. It's not just one or two strong sports that pull up those numbers. It's really across the board. We had 120 student athletes graduate in the last calendar year, and someone from all 19 sports was within that list of 120. And 11 of the 15 sport programs have a team cumulative GPA of a 3.0 or higher, and two of the four that don't actually are between 2.9 and 3.0. So we're very, very close to having 13 of the 15 programs have a 3.0 or better, and the other two have over 2.75. So we don't have any sport that is in any kind of academic trouble at all.
Just so you understand, we have 19 sports, but 15 programs, because track and field has men and women outdoor and men and women indoor track, and then men and women cross country. So that's considered a program.
Right.
We compete in 19 different sports, all of which are in the Sun Belt Conference, although swimming, men's swimming, is in a little bit of a different context, because we're going to affiliate.
Yes, it will be in this year, and this year only, in all probability, we'll compete in the Conference USA Swimming and Diving Invitational. That's not the Conference USA Championship, but it's an invitational that coincides with their championship, because you have to have at least three schools in order to claim a conference championship. And the Sun Belt Conference on the men's side will just have two swimming programs this year. The conference, in all likelihood, will add affiliate members moving forward, so that'll just be a one-year anomaly there. But this year, when it comes February and our swimming and diving are competing, and you hear this Conference USA Swimming and Diving Invitational, and what happened there, what does that mean? That's just so they have a chance to win a championship this winter, which they otherwise would not have.
These academic credentials are very impressive for our student athletes.
And, you know, our coaches deserve a lot of credit, mm-hmm. because, as all of you know, if you don't have your immediate boss or the person who oversees you reinforcing the core components that are necessary to achieve at this level, it's not as likely to happen. And our coaches really emphasize that. They sit players out if they miss study halls. I mean, there's a high level of expectations and discipline in all of our programs if academic standards, basic academic standards, aren't met. And I think without that from our coaches, it wouldn't be as good. Our student athletes are very, very dedicated too. I mean, it's a very good combination that we have. This sign, I put this up. We've got it up in about 10 different places in our administrative offices. There are a lot of keys to success, but to me, these are two of them. And I just wanted this to be a visual reminder on a daily basis to all of our staff. What the Be Proactive means is that I think that if you come to work today and all you think about is what you need to do today, I don't think we get better. But if we come to work today and we think about tomorrow and next week and next month and 6 months from now, and then discuss what can we do now to better prepare us for that, we will get better. So that's what that means. And the don't settle, you know, that's obvious too, but I think there can be a danger when you have a pretty high level of success like we've had, both athletically and academically. In any walk of life, complacency can set in. You have people pat you on the back and tell you you're doing a good job. You can indirectly let your guard down. We can't have that. You know, we can't settle. There are things that we can do we haven't done, and I want us to continue to aspire to do bigger and better things that we've never done. And the thing that I say is, honestly, I mean, if you really look at it, unless we're winning a championship in every sport, unless we're graduating 100% of our student athletes, and unless we sell out every single venue, then there is room to grow. There is improvement. Now, obviously, there's a very ambitious goals, and the likelihood of all that happening is that, you know, the odds wouldn't be in favor of that. But to me, we haven't maxed out. There are a lot of things we can do that we haven't done, and I just don't want us to settle. I want us to continue to aim big and be aggressive in everything that we do, and really just take the approach that, like we said in the video, the sky really is the limit. Don't let other people tell us what we can and cannot do. Let's raise the bar ourselves. I'd be happy to take any questions if any of you have anything.
What's your philosophy on your coaching staff in recruiting? I mean, is your philosophy to stay within Kentucky, to go to the neighboring states, to get the good student athletes? I don't understand how you go about doing something like that.
Well, it varies from sport to sport. Certainly, we want to recruit the Commonwealth of Kentucky and get every good player and good person from our state that we can. In some sports, like football in particular, the high school football in Kentucky is not as strong as a high school football in Florida or Georgia or Louisiana. So that's why when you look at our roster, you'll see more players from some of those other states. We're fortunate in football in that both our head coach and Raymond Woody, who is our recruiting coordinator, have deep ties within the state of Florida. And what they've enabled us to do over now the three recruiting classes that we've had, and I think you'll see that this year, is we've built a lot more depth on our team through that. But we certainly want to recruit the Commonwealth of Kentucky very heavily. And in other sports, in volleyball, you know, Travis Hudson's done a great job of recruiting Louisville and other areas. And, you know, if there's somebody that's good enough in your backyard, then certainly sign them. We don't have to go halfway across the country to find somebody that's equal to somebody that's already here.
Do you attend the recruiting too, or just the respective coaches?
Well, I will meet with recruits when they come to campus. Our coaches will often bring them by my office to meet. I don't actually go on the road and recruit and go in living rooms and things of that nature, but I do meet with them when they come to campus. Okay. Anyone else? All right. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Ty.
Thank you. Next item is auxiliaries, year-end report. John?
Let me kind of set the stage for John a little bit. This is not a year-end report that we've made very often in the past, but over the last several years, we've had considerable discussion, particularly as we've prepared for and embarked on a renovation of the Downing University Center and how important auxiliary revenues are to the university's budget. We particularly, now that that's paying for the revenues from our auxiliary operations, is paying for a significant portion of the Downing Center renovation. I felt like it was appropriate and helpful to give this board a year-end report on just how our auxiliary services performed this past year. John?
Well, thank you. And I would add to that not only are we budgeting and planning to reinvest in our Downing Center as we know it today, but just as Todd mentioned, we got to be looking down the road, and we are. And with that in mind, knowing that we've got Garrett Conference Center, Garrett Food Court, that is in pretty tired condition, it's very much so the very next targeted location for our major investment. I guess that was almost my closing, was to say that in 2015, that's where we hope to put our focus after Downing Center completes in 14. So we're already planning our fiscal operations in terms of dining anyway to do that. I put this definition up here only because it's common that folks would say, what is auxiliary services anyway? You know, I get that. When people ask me what I do at the university and I mention auxiliary services, I often have, well, what does that mean? Well, auxiliary services is nothing more within higher education, an industry in, to itself, that are units that are set up to, of course, charge fees and services and provide goods. It's business operations of the university. And NACUBO, the National Association of College and University Business Officers, adopted this definition quite some time ago. But here, what is auxiliary services at WKU? You just approved in June a budget for fiscal 12-13 that had auxiliary services included, and part of the presentation you received defined the university's budget. And auxiliary services, by this illustration, is 6.2% of the total revenues of the university. So within the units of auxiliary services, what do we focus on? You know, this is not a mission statement by no means, but it gives you an idea that we are self-supporting entities. That's the key here, is that auxiliary units are not receiving any support from funds that are state funds or EG funds, and so they are separate from the university's operations in that they are self-supporting, but they also strive to support the academic mission of the institution. But I would focus on the last phrase there, is that we truly do everything possible to enhance the quality of life with those services. In other words, housing and dining cannot be separated, as well as bookstore and many other units within auxiliaries that accentuate and enhance the overall quality of life on campus. So that's, if you had to pick a phrase that we really focus on, it's enhancing
the quality of life for students. And as I mentioned, auxiliary services is an industry within itself, within higher education. There are numerous national, regional, and state organizations that are dedicated to assisting universities everywhere with enhancing the staff and the functions within auxiliary services. I regularly attend, many of the staff within auxiliary services regularly attend these meetings. Auxiliary services is where I've come from. That's where I've been in my professional career a long time. That's where when I go to a conference at National Association of College Auxiliary Services is one of those, it's always on my annual hit list. And it's amazing how much I benefit from participating in those sessions, meeting those vendors. And it's the same for the staff that we are regular presenters and active members of many of these organizations. Okay, here's auxiliary services at WKU is broke. This is a cumbersome arrangement, but notice only here the blue on the right. My pointer. On the right here is the units within my division. This is my division entirely. But why Howard came up and joined me is that auxiliary services on our campus is divided between two divisions. There are part of auxiliary services within student affairs. There's part of auxiliary services within campus services and facilities. I have Gary Mazaros with me here today, who is the assistant VP for auxiliary services within our division, and he has the ID center, restaurant catering group, bookstore, and postal and printing. I purposely didn't point out parking and transportation, even though that reports to him. Parking and transportation is not solely owned by as a unit, so to speak. It is a revenue-dependent department. A good example would be the action you just took to use university resources to buy a land that would be converted into a parking lot is an example of it's not entirely independent as an auxiliary. In other words, it's supplemented by other resources. So it's not a true auxiliary, but it functions as a auxiliary to the extent possible and revenue-dependent. So we've included it in that division, or within that unit. Howard will outline for you how Student Affairs has auxiliary units.
The two primary auxiliary units in the Student Affairs division are Housing Resident Life and our Student Activities, which is headed up by Dr. Pride, and Brian Cooster heads up Housing and Resident Life. Housing and Resident Life, under the leadership of Dr. Ransdale, developed a unique but outstanding program in creating a foundation, which is the Student Life Foundation. And I can only say that we're envied by institutions throughout the country. I can't go anywhere without someone wanting to know about our Student Life Foundation, which has allowed us to invest. First of all, we've been able to sell bonds, take those dollars, renovate our own facilities. We own our facilities and then invest back into them, and have done so from a very sound business model that I'm going to allow. I'm going to have Brian Cooster going to talk a little bit about some of those.
I just put a couple slides together. Just wanted to kind of show you the investment in residence halls, kind of as it says by the numbers. And since the inception of Student Life Foundation, we have invested over $100 million in the halls. We have issued about $91 million in debt. But the good news is we only owe $76 million now. our annual debt service is $61 million. And the thing that I wanted to share was since Dr. Ransdale became president in 97, at that point we had 3,800 students living on campus, but we had 5,500 beds. As of last fall, we had 4,800 and 42 students after settle in. we always open full, but we have students that will leave campus for whatever reason. So 48-42, it was our end of the year number. Since 2000, every bed on campus has been renovated, to everything from being gutted to going in and replacing furniture, all the fixtures. Again, no other school in the state or the region can say that, and I would say very few schools across the country could say that. We also did some things that maybe outside of the residence halls, but we constructed a central chill water plant where we provide chill water not only to the residence halls but also to university buildings. This building is one of those buildings, and it really allows us to reduce our energy cost and maintenance cost. The PFT food court, another example of a building that the Student Life Foundation built. In the fall, we hope to have
One point on that, on the chill water, a little known but fascinating wrinkle, is that we can now buy chilled water from the Student Life Foundation much cheaper than we can buy it from TVA.
Okay. The new apartments we are opening here in the fall, and as Regent Ridley and I were talking earlier, that building, it took us 4 minutes to fill up all the female spots that students went online and reserved spots. The men are a little slower. It took the men 8 minutes to fill their apartment.
So right. We didn't underprice those beds, did we?
Again, if we're going to build something, we need to be able to provide a service that somebody else in town is not providing. And so those are a very good value for the students. And I hope when we have our dedication that you're able to come and see those facilities. Very, very nice. And we also have purchased property for future growth on Kentucky Street across from where our new apartments are at there by the new parking structure. I wanted to share, again, you think how much we've invested, but if you look at what the value is to our students compared to the other state schools, again, we're middle of the road. Mm-hmm. There's three schools that are more expensive for their standard Debra room, and then there's four schools that are less expensive. And I think, you know, that's, you know, what we want to be. We don't want to be the highest. We don't want to be the lowest either. I think that when we price our units, quite honestly, it's not necessarily, we don't necessarily compare ourselves against other state schools. It's the local Bowling Green market, because, you know, we do have a captured market for our freshmen and sophomores with that required housing, but it's our juniors and seniors that we want to continue to entice to stay on campus. And, because our juniors and seniors want to stay on campus, it puts more pressure on us to find spaces for our incoming students. So this year, as an example, we have asked some of the sophomores if they would like to live off campus for the fall. It's a, you know, good position to be in, but again, I just wanted to share with you kind of where we're at across the state. And then lastly, this is just our revenues since 2001, since the inception of the Student Life Foundation. Again, I think the board does remember from presentation back in January, the Student Life Foundation actually owns the residence halls and the surrounding land, and that's the entity that we use to borrow money and do renovations. But the university actually operates and makes the day-to-day decisions with those residence halls. The foundation has no employees. It does have a 9-member volunteer board, but all the day-to-day decisions are made within the Department of Housing and Residence Life.
You know, one question, and I looked at and this is really for Ann. Since the issuance for the Student Life Foundation was in 2000, and you have outstanding bonds of $76 million, and I'm sure you've already surpassed your call protection, which is usually 10 years, I would think you'd have substantial savings if you refunded those bonds in today's market.
Well, the way that that these bonds are done, we're actually a variable rate, and we have done some
You need a swap.
Swaps.
Yeah, you're underwater with a swap.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I know why you're not doing it then.
Yeah. But again, you think about in 2000.
I agree. It was the right thing to do. That's the right thing to do in 2000.
Yeah. And we have renegotiated some of those because those swaps are for a limited period.
Again, the value of that is that's not university debt.
I understand, but you have to lease that
deal. The Student Life Foundation can be nimble. They can make business decisions from climate to climate, mm-hmm. quarter to quarter, year to year. That's in the best interest and manage those numbers. And it's a complete off-balance sheet recapitalization of those properties, and it's a terrific business plan. And the university has no exposure, risk, or liability, debt obligation.
Yeah.
And the foundation has sovereign immunity.
Yes, absolutely.
And again, I think it's worth repeating that all the revenues that are generated go back and are reinvested in the facilities. We're not paying shareholders. It all goes back into the facilities.
We've eliminated the middleman in the rebuilding of our residence-like properties, and there is no profit margin. It all goes back in, which is in the student's best interest, and students at another campus in this state are going to be paying dearly for many years to come to the for-profit enterprise out of Memphis, Tennessee that's doing that project.
Okay. And we're very, we didn't start construction on our new apartment.
No, I need to say
literally didn't break ground until September. And here, students are moving in.
And their installations are going to go.
Thank you. Right. Any questions?
This next slide, Charlie Pride heads up the student activities. This is a breakdown of how student fees go back into the development of the programs. And Charlie, feel free to jump in and elaborate if you see fit. But all of those student fees go back to the students. This is also on the right-hand side. This is the way we operate the Student University Center. And these on the left, we have how the fees are distributed among those programs, including student government, which develops our students. I want to place some emphasis on our leadership program, which is unique for WKU, in that we want our students to have, when they leave the institution with a degree, that they also have an above average skill in leadership and communication, that our students are sought after in the corporate world and in education because they have gone through numerous programs. These are volunteer programs. The Leadership Dynamics program, which has four stages, that they have been exposed to a level of leadership training that is normally only seen at the corporate level. So they go into their first professional job understanding what is expected of them as they move up the corporate ladder. And that's done primarily through the student activities program.
John? Okay. Coming back to my division. Within my division, you've already heard we've got it divided between the two. One of the units under Gary Massaros that he oversees is, of course, our bookstore program. One of the things that you may be interested in is that the bookstore is projected to generate 36% of the total amount of auxiliary revenue. So it's not the largest entity, but it's 36% of the auxiliary, and that number is right at $9 million is expected in sales by the bookstore in the upcoming year. Just as an illustration here, just so that you can catch up, the two images, of course, are our primary locations at the present time as it relates to the main campus. Just a reminder, we're now in the ballroom of Garrett, and we'll be there for a year. And we've recently opened a satellite store on Nashville Road. It's done quite well since it opened. And the bottom image is where the bookstore will be going. In other words, when the bookstore reoccupies Downing Center, it will be at street level. on in the renovated building, and the entrance to it will be just to the right of this image. This is looking at the renovated Downing Center elevation from Avenue of Champions side, facing down the building or up campus.
So the entrance is going to be pretty close to where the Regents Park, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. Okay.
That's correct.
It'll be very accessible for ball games, for apparel, all
incredible. That's the whole intent.
Bigger department store.
First floor street ground entrance is, yeah, and this may sound unusual, but I don't know what they were thinking when they created the Downing Center in 1968 by putting it on what was then considered the third floor. Mm-hmm. It was really an unusual arrangement. Now, we've made it work, don't get me wrong, but this is where it belongs, and so part of the renovation is the reshuffling of locations and business operations within the building.
Well, also, this renovation will allow us to open the bookstore at different hours, and we're not required to have the entire facility open,
right,
which is also was a shortcoming in that anytime to get to the bookstore or any other part of the building, we had to staff and manage the entire facility. This will allow the bookstore to function very independent and set up their own hours if they.
With all due respect, this could have been done in 1968 had they been planning it different. In other words, all that space that's down there could have been relocated elsewise, and this could have happened. I don't know. They just didn't, okay?
But, John, quick question.
Yeah.
And you may be addressing us later when you talk about Alumni Square, what used to be Block 12. The plans for a bookstore, gift shop, however we designated in Alumni Square, could you address that a little bit, or do you want to save it for later?
I think that fits right in. In addition to the main campus and the Nashville Road location, our bookstore has three other satellite locations already in place, one in Owensboro, one in Glasgow, and one at South Campus. Now, the intent is that within Block 12, when the financing is available, there will be a bookstore component there. Now, I must emphasize, though, it's not going to be traditional, I don't think, in terms of its focus. It will have these items, but they got to find another niche or another market there to make that succeed. We've got, when we do the renovation of Downing Center, bring it to street level, and if we were to keep the Nashville Road store open, we're going to be readily accessible in the community. So our market coming to the conference center and hotel is going to be our market, and we're going to market to them.
Would you even consider, like, carrying items like because of student housing, bread, milk?
Absolutely. There's going to be, in addition to a bookstore component, there will be what's called a pod, a
convenience store.
Provisions on demand, which is a branded concept that Aramark has for its convenience store. So we've already arranged to partner with Aramark, WKU Dining and Catering Restaurant Group, to put in a convenience store concept in that.
We're aware, as you have approved this morning, for us to put more Greek housing on Center Street, and with the opening of the new apartments and the future apartments across the street on Kentucky, actually there's a paradigm shift of moving students and creating a different community on the northeast side of the campus. So we are studying how we can best meet their needs.
Well, you have that new facility that's opening any second now in the old junior high.
Was it
200 people in there? That's a lot of people.
We will soon be connected to the city at that point, yes.
WKU Restaurant Catering Group. Just a quick overview. You've seen this before. This is nothing more but a shot from one of their marketing brochures. What I want to remind you is that there was a time on this campus when, and not that long ago, all of our dining was focused in Downing Center and Garrett, and we have, through reinvestment and through growth in the program, been able to expand it to now have outlets, of course, at all areas around the campus, and it has been successful, as demonstrated by this slide, in that dining revenues, I'm just talking about gross sales of what dining has been able to produce, has gone from $7.2 million in gross annual sales in 2002 to $17.5 million just this past year. So we've experienced $10 million in sales increase in those 10 years. Yes, sir.
John, would that include catering sales and sales at Nicely?
Yes, sir, it would. When I talk about dining revenues, I'm talking about revenues that's generated by our contractor, which in this case is Aramark, and that would include all sales, of which we participate in a commission as it auxiliary services. So they're not our revenues. They're not counted in part. For example, when I say that last year they should finish the year on June 30 with 17.5 in gross revenue sales, that's Aramark sales. It's not university sales. So it's not included in what I described earlier as what we define as revenues in auxiliary services.
But it all occurred on our campus. So.
It all occurs on our campus, but it's their sales.
And our share of
what
that.
We count as revenue is the commission income we got off of it, which is for this coming year projected to be $1.9 million. So we expect to get a return of $1.9 on those sales.
What percent is that like?
We start out at a base of 8, and then we have a graduated process where at the end of the year we settle up, where at the end of the year, if there is an excess above that, then it comes our way as well.
Yeah, I remember one year on the board that you all put out an RFP for the concession service. I haven't seen it for a long time. Was it like a 8-year or a renewal?
It's actually it was a 10 with a 5-year option.
Okay, so it's been a long time.
Those kinds of contracts generate the kind of investment you want and need from the outside companies when you do those arrangements. I mean, it's like Pepsi, Coke, Aramark, Sodexo. I mean, there are vendors out there that are very eager, but they prefer, if you want a front-end investment from them into your program to update, modernize, and expand, then you need to give them a lengthy contract.
Did you exercise the 5-year option?
Yes, we did. So we didn't exercise it until we negotiated with considerable negotiation, and we're going to be receiving close to $5 million from Aramark in these revenues to put back into Downing Center and other locations over the course of those 5 years. 3 will come in the form of an upfront amount, and then we will get $400,000 a year with it. It's already in the deal.
On those spot sales, is that also get included in this count and in the revenues that we're incurring?
Yes, sir. Our contract with Aramark is an exclusive. That means that they have all university activities and functions, and all of that comes back in, and we reinvest it. This growth that I just showed you around campus could only have happened with the revenues and locations and so forth unless we had a capital reinvestment. And obviously it's worked. I mean, students are responding. It's amazing the growth the program has seen in the last 10 years, and it's due to reinvestment. Let's talk about the ID card system. We have an ID card. It's more than just an ID card, as we all know. We call it the Big Red Card. It's been in place many years. I think we put it in place in auxiliary services to serve the university as a whole at our total expense back in 1982. I mean, that long ago, we put the Big Red Card in place. Before that, we had an ID card system run out of HR. What I'm getting at is that the Big Red Card has, for a very long time, been a part of auxiliary services that serves students in that it allows students to carry a single card with a mag stripe. They can use it for all their transactions related to dining, whether it be access to for their residential program. They can even buy off of vending machines, pay for health services, even pay for a ticket at the police department or parking department. In other words, it's set up with readers all over campus that allow students to use the monies on deposit. And we have partnered in the community. We have over 30 local businesses that are now accepting and promote the fact that any dollars on deposit with auxiliary services is able to be used off campus. And, of course, we have negotiated an arrangement to get a small return on those sales to go off campus as well. So those are just logos of local vendors that are on the ID card. Also within auxiliary services is our printing and copying programs. We have a contract with RICO as well as with 7 printing companies in the community. So it's not a big generator, but it is a business operation because it serves the university community well in the way it's set up with our contracts with local community as well as on campus. I would also like to mention that there is a student program known as Students in Free Enterprise, SIFE, that operate within that unit that is entirely dedicated to enhancing the educational experience for students in our business programs. Now, with that, the only thing I would close by saying is that to make it an annual report, we are expecting auxiliary services at the end of this year, after all expenditures are made and so forth, to once again have somewhere in the vicinity of $1.3 million just from the units within my area that would be made available for carry forward and reinvestment. One more slide. Oops. Why did I forget that? How could I forget this? Also in the past year, not only did we negotiate a five-year extension with Theramark that we felt was very beneficial to all parties, but we've also this past year awarded a contract to Coca-Cola. I think you've heard about it. It started in January, so they had their first semester. They've done well. They've reached their sales quotas, and we are benefiting in that. This contract is going to be valued for us at $6 million over the 10-year term. This is a 10-year contract, and we will receive the institution a benefit of $6 million over that 10 years. That results in sales in both vending and retail. Now, what I mean by retail is there's a lot of beverage sold in our retail operations, as well as our C-stores, etc. So all these coolers that are on campus, in addition to vending, also generate an income for auxiliary services with this now exclusive contract with Coca-Cola. We have 110 vending machines in total, but 70 of them are drink. The only other number I would add to this would be how much athletics also benefits from this contract. And not only does auxiliary services receive money, but athletics over the 10-year term will receive $2.6 million in benefits directly to them in prepaid advertising and other ways, such as they have agreed to have a suite in the arena and provide beverages and drinks and product to them at discounted rates, as well as outright purchasing advertising from athletics. So athletics will benefit $2.6 million over the term of the 10 years. Auxiliary services through retail and vending would profit by $3.4 million in the 10 years. But once again, all this is about enhancing the quality of life on campus and reinvesting to expand and improve the program. We are a program of envy. When I'm at other schools, because of what we've done in dining, because of what we've done in housing, because of what we're doing in other areas, I don't mind telling you, we're envied by many other schools by what we're doing. We get called regularly on getting questions about how did you pull that off. That's because they hustle. They're good folks.
And it sure makes Brian Meredith's job easier.
Mm-hmm. Just a quick question. On the build-out of Alumni Square, have you identified or do you have any potential timetable for the finishing out of that? And number two, have you identified possible sources of funds to do that project, to finish it up?
I think actually Ann might be the better one to respond to that. She's part of the downtown redevelopment, or the TIF group, and well, so is John, but Ann's been tracking these numbers very closely for the last 2 years.
We had a conference call this week with some bond counsel and advisors. It has been a challenge and a disappointment because we were counting on new market tax credits as a significant component of the funding package. And while we've gone as aggressively as we can to identify any entities that may have allocations, we are now on a wait list for any project potentially that might fall through and a community development entity that is looking for an alternative project. So what we are discussing right now is a continual phasing of Alumni Square, where more than likely the SPE2, the entity that actually would issue the bonds in conjunction with Warren County, That bonds would be sold probably October, and that would allow for a completion of the alumni center, the police station, the parking garage office. And I think that's good news because the bond interest rates have been so favorable that we can complete that. But what we're exploring is the phasing of the project, which would mean the other piece that that you raised about the bookstore market cafe would have to be in the next phase, perhaps in a discussion of whether there's a new market tax credit opportunity in conjunction with maybe a restaurant and a hotel.
What are the approximate costs of those two phases?
Off the top of my head, perhaps I can do a report at the Finance Budget Committee in September. I think the component that we are saying may have to be delayed is approximately $1.8 million. But I am pleased to. There's been so much uncertainty about completing the other portions that we really believe that the bond rates dropping will facilitate the leases that are in place to ensure the completion of the rest of the block.
We had anticipated getting approximately $30 million in new market tax credits, which would be bought by banks, which would have netted about $6 to $7 million in the business plan, financing plan for the retail properties, including the police station. But Kentucky did not get an allocation last year in the federal allocation of new market tax credits, and therefore our partners, which are primarily Metro Bank in Louisville, and their primary niche is the sale and transactions related to new market tax credits, did not get an allocation. And so we and everybody else in Kentucky had to defer any plans dependent upon new market tax credits this past year. And I don't know the politics at the federal level of how those get distributed, but Kentucky did not get a distribution last year.
Thank you.
Thank you, John. Is that it?
Good, thank you.
Good job.
Next item is fundraising year-end report. Ms. Costello.
Please tell me if you cannot hear me. I think I have a very loud voice, and some of them do not. But I've asked my two colleagues, J.P. Blair and Don Smith, to come to help us get the year-end report, which really coincides with the end of the campaign. I'm not giving you a campaign over yet, but you know it's been successful. And if you will, don't manage this and get right. I want to do a couple of things. The number of people who helped make this happen, including all of our staff, this is the entire campaign cabinet. And you will notice your newest regent is a member. So you should thank them on two counts, becoming a regent and being a member. There are lots of things that a campaign does, and the number that everybody focuses on is the amount of money we raised in total. But I want to share some other numbers that reflect what a campaign does for the campus. We had in this campaign 42,795 total donors. That is 42,795 people who have invested in the future of the university by being donors. That's a very powerful constituency for us going forward. 8,278 alumni and friends donated $1,000 or more. We had, importantly, 1,692 faculty and staff who are donors. And that number is growing all the time. And we had 181 new members of the Society of 1906, which is our planned giving society. This is our year-end total, but it also is part of the campaign. Donations this year totaled $17,854,000 and some change, the second highest fundraising year on record. The year that was higher was when we got the large gift from Houchins. So when you have a spike of a big gift, you can't always replicate that, though our goal would be to do so.
That was a $5 million check all at once.
Right.
pretty hard to make up for that spike the following year.
but interestingly, again, by the numbers, 243 major gift donors. That meant people who gave $10,000 or more. That's also an important group for the future. $7 million raised in the annual fund. That's a pretty remarkable effort. Donald and his team worked very, very hard to get in touch with the alumni and friends and to raise that money. We have 2,511 President's Circle donors. This is an important constituency now and in the future. And alumni contributed $5.6 million. These are embedded in this total. So we had a very good year at the end of the campaign, and that's not an easy thing to do. I've been involved personally with almost $2 billion in campaigns. It's unusual the last year of the campaign to see those totals remain so high because you've had a seven-year effort and there's often a fall-off as people have paid off pledges. So we feel very happy about that. Now, September 21st, before we tell you the rest of the campaign information, is the gala. And this is an advertisement. It's going to be so much fun. We're going to have lots of students entertainment. It will be fast-moving. It will be like an Emmy Awards or Academy Awards, and it will be a surprise. The program itself will be about 1 hour long, so the whole time you're going to be so busy. It's been an hour and so, and then dinner dancing following that. I really do urge you to come. The students are performing. The surprise video we have for you to see the engagement of students in the end of this campaign as they have been throughout the campaign is going to be a lot of fun. So mark your calendar September 21st. We have a lot of other things going on that day, but it really will be worthwhile. And now I'm going to ask John Paul Blair, he and Donald and all of the team, as I told you last year, I get to celebrate the end of the campaign. I had absolutely nothing to do with its success. But I can tell you that the people who did, starting with our president, who is probably the best fundraising president in the country, and a staff that is so dedicated, I've never seen anything like it anywhere. And they are the ones that are due the credit along with the volunteers. But I want to say at the last day of the campaign, John Paul and his major gift staff, Donald and the annual fund alumni relations staff were working just as hard as with as much enthusiasm as they did the first day. So I'm going to ask JP to give you the final little bits of information and then ask Donald to talk just a bit about Alumni Square and some of the things going on there.
Well, you're far too humble as far as your role in the campaign, Catherine. We appreciate your leadership and appreciate the leadership of the president and our volunteers and probably most importantly, our donors who made all of these numbers a reality. I want to apologize for the presentation being so weighted in numbers. I am glad they are big, heavy numbers, though. But we are in a numbers business, and you know that's really what it's all about. But we've broken down the numbers into people, places, and programs to just try to demonstrate to you some of the impact that it's had and will have on our campus. Beginning with student scholarships, you can see that $54 million was given over the course of the campaign for student scholarship support, including $11 million in new scholarship endowments. And then the awards from those endowments and scholarship funds are just incredible, impacting 6,500 students at the tune of $38.5 million. Also, our faculty, five new endowed faculty positions in horticulture, economics, honors, to name a few, to create a total now of 31 endowed faculty positions across our campus. Places demonstrates the physical transformation of our campus, a lot of which has been done with public funds, a lot of which has been done with private funds, as illustrated here. By the names associated there. Our staff jokingly said that these names are icons building icons on our campus. A lot of these names are people that are iconic and you know them in our community and beyond, from Bob Adams all the way through. And these places are making a tremendous impact daily on our campus now. And then finally, the programs from Bill Gatton's investment to enhance
are now number one ranked Gatton Academy of Math and Science. Dixie and Pete Mehurin's philanthropic partnership with the university to help bring the World Gifted Council to our campus. ExxonMobil's investment that was matched by another $1 million to help expand the science and the teaching of science and to help to address that significant need that we have across the Commonwealth. To one of our newest programs, our physical therapy program, which would not be would not have been possible were it not for the $700,000 in private commitments that have been given to this point. And then Logan Aluminum investing in our engineering program, Toyota, in our Center for Gifted Studies, and the James Graham Brown $500,000 commitment that helped to push us over the finish line as we finished our campaign. My last slide talks about the deferred gifts, and in this campaign we received about 30% of our total, a little more than that, was in the form of deferred gifts. That's right about the national average. And again, just to demonstrate that this is more than a number, really, I don't think there's any higher honor that the university can receive as when people include the university along with their family, their friends, their life passions in their estate planning. So we're honored that $60 million in those commitments during this campaign were documented. That's part of about a $95 million total from over 300 individuals now who've included us and given us that highest honor.
Thank you, JP. This shows that campaigns keep on giving, and we'll see benefits from this over the coming years, and you and future boards will benefit as you see money coming into the university that was given by people who cared enough today, as JP said. Donald Smith has been the tireless person involved with the activities in what used to be called Block 12, which is now called Alumni Square. He has led the effort with Dale Augenstein for the Augenstein Alumni Center. And again, the dedication of these two men, they're men of high quality, great integrity, and I'm just so pleased to have had a chance to work with them. And I thought Donald could give you a couple of updates on some things that happened, and actually the ideas were basically his, so he deserves to get to talk about it.
I guess let me start segueing with the campaign and talk a little bit about the WKU Alumni Association, and the reason these gifts happen is people have developed a life and a relationship with the institution over a period of time, and we're really concerned about the lifetime value of a graduate from the time a person first comes on this hill, and the cradle-to-grave mentality, so to speak, and we even have our columbarium on campus now with the Chandler Chapel, so we can really get it at both ends of the spectrum. But your Alumni Association works hard to involve people in the life of the institution. Last year, we had more than 240 events that impacted our alumni and friends. And as an example, a couple of nights ago at Freddie Higdon's house, there was an event for people in Lebanon. We're having an event Monday night at Melissa Dennison's home. So we do a lot of those types of activities to keep people engaged. We have more than 240 events that impacted our alumni base. We had more than 1,500 volunteers that gave of their time and their energy to help the Alumni Association. And a big piece of this that Catherine mentioned is the Augenstein Alumni Center that we're gearing up for now. It's an exciting time for the Alumni Association. We will celebrate our centennial in 2013. We were founded in 1913, so what a perfect opportunity to open the Augenstein Alumni Center in our centennial year. And special thanks to Jim Johnson and Melissa Dennison and John Ridley, who all have been gracious donors to the Augenstein Alumni Center so far. And Jim, when you were talking, I was so glad to hear you calling it Alumni Square. We're trying hard with the rebranding effort now to call it Alumni Square as opposed to Block 12, because when you talk about Block 12, people think it's a prison block or something. Alumni Square at least gives it a little more identity, and Dr. Ransdell has worked with the Warren County Downtown Economic Development Authority with that branding, and you'll start to see signs around the downtown that will have Fountain Square, Circus Square, Shake Rag Square, Alumni Square, that start to brand those different areas of the TIF district as opposed to calling them block numbers. So Alumni Square is what we'll call it. You noticed on your map when we were talking about the Greek Village that 14th has already been renamed Alumni Avenue. And so the area that borders between Center Street, Alumni Avenue, 13th Street, and Kentucky Street will all be affectionately known as Alumni Square. The Augenstein Alumni Center will open in spring of 2013. Part of the financial performance is to have 1,000 donors at $1,000. We've had now more than 600 of those donors, and then we've had more than $4.5 million raised from what we call major gifts, too, those $10,000 gifts and above. So fundraising has been going extremely well, and we're excited about that opening in 2013. So I do have some brochures here for you. I'd be glad to answer any questions on Alumni Square, but this talks about what's going to be in the building. But it truly will create a place for alumni to call home. From the time the admissions tour starts, when Brian Meredith brings them first on campus and they walk through the WKU Museum and they see the Hall of Distinguished Alumni Inductees like Larnell Harris that will be featured up there, and they can truly realize that anything is possible with that WKU degree. We'll have boardrooms. We'll have a library with all the books that are written by WKU faculty, staff, students, and alumni. There'll be a living room. There'll be auditorium space that DLO, the Division of Extended Learning and Outreach, will manage. It'll hold up to 300 dinner style. So when people come back on campus, there's a true place for them to call home. And we're extremely excited about it and appreciate everything everybody's doing to make this a reality.
If I may mention one other thing, thank you, Donald, and then we'll, if you have any questions, we'll answer them. Not here today, but here in our hearts, is Alex Downing. The partnership with College Heights Foundation, so strong. And the WKU Foundation and College Heights have just recently reached a wonderful agreement on ways we'll work in the future. We've always worked well together, but we're going to, in the future, put all scholarship endowments in College Heights Foundation. No one does a better job than they of stewardship, and it's been their primary purpose since the beginning. The WKU Foundation will receive gifts, all gifts of other types, and it's really not a major shift, but it's an organized plan to go forward. Alex has been a wonderful partner and is an extended part of our team, even doing more than anybody can imagine. So I want to credit them as we talk about this success, and to tell you on quietly that we will be moving this fall into a dedicated scholarship campaign. All of our team, College Heights, volunteers on both boards. And the goal will be to keep momentum going in terms of fundraising, but to see that we do more to secure scholarships for our students, something that you deal with all the time. So we feel while this is an end, like everything else, it's a commencement, and we begin again. And we look forward to that and be happy to answer questions if you have them.
Outstanding results.
See you on the 21st, if not before.
Good job. Thank you. All three of you.
Next item is research year-end report. Dr. Bayless.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity to come here and talk about research. It's been a very challenging year. I think my my counterparts around the country will typically use stronger language than that, language more like disastrous. But I'm certainly not going to say that. And the reason I'm not going to say that comes down to the vision that Dr. Ransdell has articulated for this university, that we're not a research university. We're an engaged university that's deeply connected to the community, to the businesses, to the region, to the economic development here. That goal is actually part of the solution, as I hope you'll see as I move forward. If we were an entirely research university, our entire focus would be on the federal government. Well, what can we say about the federal government? It really has been a terrible year in terms of the federal government. Earmarks, and as Dr. Ransdell pointed out...
I'm not real good at Latin, but tell me exactly what that says.
Annus Horribilis, a terrible year.
As Queen Elizabeth said when she had one of those.
Yes.
Yes.
Indeed. We used to enjoy earmarks in the region of, you know, $8 to $10 million a year. They're finally phased out. Last year we had the last. We don't expect any more. But there's a little caveat there I'll talk about later. Whole programs of federal research support have been cut. Obviously, you know, we might have an outstanding program, the Center for Gifted Studies, lauded as one of the best in the nation, and they're funded by a federal program that no longer exists. Well, what can we do about that? What can they do about it? Well, not a lot. That's down to the federal government, essentially. The other thing is that a number of programs, even though they're still in place, problems with federal funding means that they have uncertain funding cycles. They push funding cycles back over time. They cancel occasional ones. That makes it very challenging to chase their money. So having said that, let's see how we do with federal money. Now, what I've got here is the year-on-year change from this year compared to last year. So starting out, how do I get a... Whoop.
Jeff, there you go.
How do I get the little pointer?
Borrow it from me.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Okay. So, first of all, earmarks. Our last earmarks were close to $6 million. They occurred last year, this fiscal 2012, nothing. Right? This represents the programs which have simply evaporated. We had about over $3 million in programs that are simply gone. You take out that, and what is within our power, the competitive grants in programs that still exist, we're actually doing better than last year. We're up above $19 million.
Wow.
So we're obviously, as far, you know, we're moving forward. We will continue to move forward. It's going to be a lot more challenging. Now, I put a little thing here in the earmarks. Now, earmarks you think of as a non-competitive thing. Your congressman writes you into to a bill somewhere, and you get the money a year or two later. We know those aren't going to come back, but there's something a little bit, there's something a gray area between earmarks and competitive grant funding, where it has evaporated. We got close to $2 million in this. These are programs where an item is written into a budget where it's pretty clear that there is a limited number of people that are going to be able to compete for it. So it's a sort of a competitive but not totally competitive grant funding. I think we can get these back. I think, you know, that's something that we need to work on more with our congressional folks. We can get leverage in that area where it's not exactly an earmark, but it's a little bit like an earmark. Okay, so we may be in the future years be able to get some of this funding back. But in terms of competitive grants, you know, and again, if I had put the year before, we would have had more earmarks, we'd have had lower competitive. We're on the right trajectory. We're going up where it's under our control. But that's only really part of the picture. This is overall extramural funding. How are we going to respond to the challenges of this? Well, the first thing we've got to do is to make sure that we're really competitive out there. We've got to have world-class facilities. I hope a message you took away from yesterday's tours is that we have some state-of-the-art facilities, and I'll talk about some more that we're building. We have to get our faculty up to speed. We have to. The granting agencies are so competitive nowadays that you almost have to have done the research to prove to them that you can do the research before you get the money to do the research. So we have to prime the pump considerably to get faculty to that level of credibility that they can get money from agencies. So we're doing a lot more of that, a lot more pilot funding. We also are advising and mentoring faculty much more. We are reviewing grant proposals much more before they go out, so that faculty often get the brutal comments from me instead of getting the brutal comments from the funding agency telling them why their proposal wasn't funded. That's sometimes rather challenging, getting those messages across. But we're focusing on our core mission. Our core mission is engagement in the region, and it's our students. What I want you to understand, I don't believe we have a standalone research mission. As Dr. Ranstow will point out, we have got to be a leader in terms of economic development, in terms of relationship with the region, and research ties into that. Research ties into a great educational experience for our students. It's not a standalone thing. It overlays onto economic development in the region. It overlays onto the teaching mission of the university. And the other thing that I would say is we have got to find new ways, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that, new ways to fund things without having to worry about the federal government. So you've seen some of our new facilities that have opened in the last year, the large chamber scanning electron microscope, the advanced materials laboratory, the high-speed computing cluster. One of the interesting problems with this that high-performance computing cluster is, I may have mentioned, that it's costing us somewhere in the region of $50,000 to $80,000 in power bill per year. Right, that's an enormous amount of electricity to run that. So, as part of this entrepreneurial approach is that we have a joint venture with BGMU to run a data center that was behind that. The whole point of that essentially is to provide this environment for the supercomputer, essentially subsidizing and funding our own research through an entrepreneurial joint venture. Two more labs that we will be building in the next few months out there. I hope you noticed that Dollar General was no longer visible at the center. They recently moved out. We're renovating that space for more laboratory facilities. A food and water laboratory that's as part of a big initiative that we have on this campus and on the Owensboro campus to really sort of get more into the food processing, food chemistry industry to help a large number of companies within our region in that space. Another lab that's going to be going in there is the phone survey lab. A lot of demand for this, again, in the community. It also ties into student-based research in Potter College. All of these labs are multifaceted labs. Therefore, extramural funding, therefore engagement with the community, and therefore giving students access to state-of-the-art research. A little bit more about pilot funding. We're putting much more emphasis on making sure that faculty have the tools of their trade as soon as they come in. New hires are provided with often considerable resources, laboratories, other facilities, to get them to that research credibility in this highly competitive environment. Internal grant funds do two things. They fund research that external agencies simply may not value, but we do value. So we have programs for funding many areas of scholarship and research that really are not fundable by external agencies typically. We also have programs to stimulate that preliminary data to get us to research credibility where we can get other people's money to fund the research.
Let's real quickly, in the 2 years that the internal program, which is the acronym is RCAP,
yes,
for the rest of the board, can you tell the board how, I mean, that has been very successful. Can you tell them how successful that's been?
The RCAP program, the internal funding, what should I say? I introduced this shortly after I came here. It's been going for 2 years. It really has two tracks identified: people who are looking to get to a point where they can get external funding, people who are looking for a scholarly product only. Immensely successful. We have distributed close to $400,000 the first year. I increased that to nearly $500,000 the second year. We can't fund everybody who applies, but I think all of the really good proposals get funded, or almost all. All the faculty in all the colleges are applying for this. Faculty actually in Potter College are the most successful, it turns out, at about an 80% success rate of getting funding on this. And ironically, the folks in Ogden College are the least successful. So that might surprise people. But to guys in science and engineering college, 60% success rate, they will consider that to be a very high success rate. When you're talking about success rates at external funding, you're talking single-digit percentages. That's what I mean by highly competitive. Yeah. So, you know, I think people are excited about it. I think people, what we've done is, these are typically rather large grants that they're up to $20,000, and they really enable faculty members to have high impact projects that are very noticeable, and in many cases do go on to bigger things. I think it's been a great success.
Yes, absolutely.
In a sense, to complement this, with the help of Provost Emsley, we've launched grants now aimed at students. And this is part of a philosophy that says, rather than teach students or simply expose them to the research of faculty, say to the students, it's up to you guys now. You guys write the grant proposal. You guys decide what research needs to be done, right? Which is a much, you know, I think the kind of education that our students are going to need increasingly for the future is that it's on them. Remember what Steve Jobs said, how do you predict the future? You invent it yourself, basically. And that's what we're asking students to do. Fuse grants, they're grant proposals written by students, highly mentored by faculty, of course. Students are expected to give presentations at a scholarly meeting. We fund them to go to that meeting. We fund their mentor to go to that meeting, as well as funding the research itself. I think so far there's a lot of excitement about this. We haven't yet seen the results in terms of those presentations because it was only launched 4 months ago. But it looks very, very promising. Students really can step up and shoulder this themselves.
And one other thing, Gordon, is that part of the requirement on the student to receive the FUSE grant is that they visit two sessions with our Office of Scholar Development.
Yeah.
Many of these ideas can be transformed into compelling proposals for these prestigious external scholarships.
Yes. Yes, yes. Thank you, Gordon. I should have mentioned that. Another challenge that we're handing down to students to invent the future for themselves is to say, well, rather than training you for a job somewhere, why don't you invent your own job? Why don't you invent your own company? So we launched the Student Business Accelerator. We have helped students create, I think, now four companies that they're entirely student-run, student-owned companies. We will provide them with absolutely outstanding mentoring from people like Doug Rohr and Jeff Hook, who unfortunately neither of them could you meet yesterday, but Jeff because he was on vacation, Doug because he's recovering from eye surgery. But these are guys who've really spent their whole lives in business, and they understand business, and they talk to students and educate them in a real life business situation. We also do provide funding to some of these students. That funding is routed through the Research Foundation. For those who are interested, they're convertible notes that we issue to students. And the notion being that if these students are incredibly successful, we'll hold equity in that company. If they go bankrupt, we'll simply write off the debt. Of course, the real point is not to make money. The point is to educate students into how to start companies and how to run businesses. And I think this is very exciting. The quality of education that some students are getting through this is outstanding. And a little bit more about some of the entrepreneurialism that we're getting involved in. I mentioned the Tier 2 data center to essentially to provide the power and heat and power and cooling for the high-performance computing center. Another example of an entrepreneurial thing that we're into is this company that we've set up as a joint venture with Electronic Warfare Associates. It's called HazWatch. You probably know that there's a lot of hazardous material that's moved around the country on trucks and on the rail lines. And you probably think to yourself, well, everybody knows what's moving where, and I'm sure that they have a plan for if anything goes wrong, and they'll know exactly what to... No. It turns out that there's very little information out there about what is traveling through your county, what we should be planning for example. And so what this is a company that provides a... We're developing an automated tool that will visually recognize those placards on trucks to actually... Initially, to be able to say, in general, what is moving through your county, what kinds of materials are moving through your county, and therefore, what kind of response teams do you need to have? And eventually, we'll move this into a domain where we can have real-time monitoring. That's down the road. Now, this is with Electronic Warfare Associates. It's also supported by the State Office of Commercialization and Innovation. $100,000 has been invested by the state in this venture. It is a for-profit company, and we are optimistic down the road that we will be making profit out of it. So, we have to go out there and be entrepreneurial and use the expertise, the great ideas of our faculty to make money to support the research enterprise here. Now, that's just to give you an overview. One thing I would like to say, I hope another message you took from the tour of the Center for Research and Development yesterday was that wonderful, brave thing that Dr. Ransdell did of buying a derelict mall that is now has now evolved into this wonderful center. What this does is it seamlessly integrates university, state, federal, and private money in a way that's a model, certainly for this Commonwealth, and perhaps for the country. And we're getting noticed. Interestingly, the State Office of Commercialization and Innovation is launching a new brand for the notion of how we do innovation in this state. How innovation and economic development from innovation should be done. It's going to be called Kentucky's Innovation Network. That will be launched on the 23rd of August. Now, it will be launched in a press conference by the governor from our Center for Research and Development. I think that's a fantastic endorsement of what people like Doug Rohrer and Jeff Hook and all the team are doing at that center. You know, that wonderful way of benefiting the region by seamlessly integrating all these programs. So I'm very proud of everything that's done there. If you have any questions about anything, happy to.
Just a comment. It's just wonderful that you're not only doing the theory, but you're doing with a lot of instances of practical. And that the students,
yes, sir.
You know, if a student's putting an application in for a position somewhere and they've been involved in the research with specific outcomes,
yes,
and they can demonstrate that they have hands-on experience, that's a lot better than just presenting an application with a degree in theory.
We hear time and time again from companies that is the worker they want. You know, and that obviously that's a big part of it. Thank you. A good comment.
Any other questions? Great tour yesterday. We appreciate it.
We time. Always enjoy showing it off.
Really good.
Thank you.
Okay. Retention progress report.
The bad penny is back again. This time with some really good news. We want to report, as we did about a year ago at the retreat, on our efforts for student success, persistence, retention, and ultimately graduation. This report was assembled by myself, but also with a lot of effort from Doug McElroy, who you met yesterday, but is currently at the American Association of State Colleges and Universities meeting, like Brian Meredith to my left, by the entire retention task force, a dedicated group of individuals, about a dozen or so, that have been meeting regularly and putting forth all kinds of good ideas, most of which we're accepting. And this document itself was put together with data from the Institutional Research Office from Housing and Residence Life. Our goals and targets, some of these are reflected in the action plan that you saw yesterday. The key things are the first year retention rate. That's the freshman to sophomore retention rate. That's the first portal. If we get them through that, then the success rate from that point on is measurably higher in each successive year. Our retention rate in first to second year is currently about 73%. And that raised to 77% is quite an ambitious goal. It's almost a 1% per year increase. And as you saw yesterday, not only is the right thing to do for students who have come here to earn a degree, but also has significant fiscal implications for the university. Now, one of our measures, and you heard Dr. Whelan talking about this yesterday, was the so-called six-year graduation rate. And it's defined in a very specific way. It does not, as Dr. Whelan mentioned, include transfer students. It does not include students who started at one place and graduate from somewhere else. It only includes students who are FTFTB, first-time, full-time baccalaureate seeking. So they have come here as a full-time student in the first semester and have announced and enrolled in a baccalaureate program. And our current six-year graduation rate for these students is just a tad under 50%. I want to stress that does not mean, as you sometimes see this reported, that less than half of our students graduate in 6 years. That's just not true. They may graduate from other colleges. They may graduate from us having started in other colleges. They may not have been full-time when they first enrolled, in which case they're not included in this cohort. Nevertheless, it's a metric that's used fairly universally, and our target is to increase that rate from just under 50% to 54%. That's 4 percentage points, or about 8% increase in the six-year graduation rate of these students. WKU actually leads the Commonwealth in our four-year graduation rate, which is actually only 25%, and yet that leads. So how do we do that? Well, we can focus on the first-year retention rate. That obviously has a role, but then we look at the next portal, if you like, the next step in the process, which is the second-year retention rate. We'd like to get that up from currently reasonably high, 87%, up to 90%. And I want to focus a lot on this group here. We have many students, a surprisingly large number of students, 5.65% of our incoming cohort, and that cohort has typically about 2,500 students in it. So maybe 130 students or so are still enrolled after 6 years. They are making progress toward a degree, but haven't actually graduated yet. For all kinds of reasons, I'll discuss some later, like double majors, who have earned all the requirements for a degree, but through their decision to earn a double major, have not yet graduated with either. We have a very aggressive effort to try and address these students, to try and finish them up. This year we had a very successful initiative to take students and finish them during the summer. We offer summer scholarship to help them do so. And I'm pleased to report, you'll see it later, that percentage, 5.65, is already down significantly. Our goal is to half it, to get down to less than 3% of students who are still enrolled after 6 years. We also need to decrease the graduation gaps of targeted groups. This is one of our CPE targets for both Pell-eligible students, that's socioeconomic, for underrepresented minorities, and for academically unprepared students. Again, not only does this have significant impact in our funding, it's the right thing to do. Now, you saw this chart or some variation of it last year. I'm a physicist. I like data. I like numbers. I like correlations. And what this is a graph showing the percentage retention rate, this critical first to second year retention rate for students with different combinations of ACT score and high school GPA. 90% retention in this corner, much lower numbers in this corner. And what we have now done is structured our admission criteria to reflect these contours. So we're admitting students not on the basis of some perceived, qualification, but on the basis of future retention. And this is the criteria that we now use. The old one was the box. If you were out here, you were so-called unconditionally admitted. If you were in this box, you were conditionally admitted. Now we just admit. But there's something we call guaranteed admission. Anyone above this line, you see it tracks the 50% retention contour and up. The so-called guaranteed admission. Below here, we have what we call competitive admission. And perhaps no admission at all. And we've kind of got a critical corner here of students who just, frankly, we were admitting and were not succeeding. I want to stress that from this point forward, everyone will be admitted. There used to be different letters saying you're admitted in this category or this other category. The key thing is they're all admitted students. What is critical at that point is something we call placement. And that is very much an advising structure. Is your initial advisor someone in your own department if you've declared a major? Is it perhaps in the STEPS program, the Cornerstone program? And these are determined through a variety of measures, individual ACT scores and subtests and so forth. But that's determined after admission. The student gets a letter saying you are admitted. And there's no funny words about conditional or what does that mean. You're admitted, and when they arrive for one of these ATP programs, they're placed according to the needs and the skills and knowledge that they have. One example of that, and we talked about this a lot last year, and now we have some data, is mathematics placement. A very critical element. Most of our incoming students have to take a mathematics course. And for a long time, we placed them all in what was called the algebra track. And that was to keep options open. Perhaps that student would eventually want to be a physics major, and therefore they'd need college algebra. But in 5 out of 6 cases, they didn't want to be a physics major. They wanted to be a major that did not require college algebra. And yet, and these are the numbers, and these are eye-opening numbers. Students who entered at this level, what we call the 055 level, the introductory course, passed through that course at a 45% rate. More than half did not make it to the next level. Of the 45% that made it to the second developmental course, the 096 course, only 15% of the total, so that's one-third of those entering 096, made it through to the next level. And those that made it through mathematics was 10% of the incoming cohort. 10%. Those whose scores placed them in the 096 course transferred through that course at a rate of 8%. 92% either failed it or are still retaking it, but did not move on to the critical credit-bearing college algebra course. And of those 8%, 5% made it through into other study. Those students who qualified for the 116 course immediately succeeded in that course at about two-thirds. And these numbers were frankly depressing. So we looked at this and realized that we had another option for these students, something called Mathematics 109. This is a survey course of mathematics. It is not a college algebra course. It will not serve as the mathematics course if you do want to be a physics major, but for most of our students, it's the mathematics they need. And we took the same three cohorts, and we have started emphasizing that it might be in their best interest to take 109, and here's the result. Those red students, if you like, the ones who are getting a 10% success rate, are now 65%. The kind of brown, orange, whatever that color that is, students, 66. And even the students who were passing through 116 at a two-thirds rate are passing through 109 at a 5/6 success rate. And these are numbers that we are starting to see already. An increase in our sophomore numbers, because these students are ready to become sophomores. They have three semester credit hours, credit-bearing courses in their books already. They're making progress to be a sophomore. So this is a wonderful success story. We're going to continue to implement this, and hopefully, you know.
Where did one go after 109? I mean, obviously you made math easier in 109 than you did in the other courses. What happens? Well, I mean, you had to do something to achieve a better success rate. But what happens after you get through? You matriculate through 109, then do you go to college algebra?
No. Depends on your major. I would argue we made math different. If you're in 116, you're solving cubic equations and quintic equations, writing theorems as to why there is no analytic solution to a quintic equation. Okay. If you're in 109, you're analyzing the application of mathematics to the stock market, to everyday life, to supply chains in business. You're seeing mathematics in the real world. That's the purpose of that course.
Analytical.
And for most majors, that is the course they need.
Okay.
And it's rigorous, and it carries academic credit, and it has the same learning outcomes that a general education course in mathematics has to have in terms of ability to manipulate data, you know, express ideas in mathematical form and so forth, but it is not aimed at students who are going to be majoring in the mathematical and physical sciences.
Then you still go to the 155, the 055 and 96.
Sorry?
The math major still takes that route.
The people who know they want to be math physics majors will still have to go through this route. Or they can take math 109 first, and then if they decide to be a physics major, they will have to backtrack and take 116. That's still, I think, more efficient than what was happening before.
Okay. And that's something that's sort of being done nationally anyway now, is it?
I'll defer. I'm not sure. I would hope so.
There's been some press on it that, you know, that this was sort of a roadblock,
yeah,
and caused dropouts, and it, you know, there's an obstacle to some people going ahead and finishing their education.
You know, other institutions are moving to this more pragmatic sort of mathematics, the 109 piece as an option.
I'd like to think, believe it or not, that this is turning more people into math majors, because they actually see how useful mathematics is. They know, maybe I want to be a chemistry major, a physics major, an engineering major, whereas after this experience, they absolutely don't want to be a a physics major or whatever. So,
but in that scenario, you then you do 116, Calc 1, Calc 2.
You go back to 116. Yes.
Do we have that data? Because that's one thing that came up last year at the department head presentation of some of this, was if you start people at 109 and then they go to a field where 116 is the required course, does that actually add time to graduation? Are we tracking that? Because I know we can't know that yet, but...
It certainly adds a course. I'm not sure it adds time to graduation. I think there's enough flexibility between the major, the minor, and the electives that this can be absorbed. But it certainly does. I would not characterize this having wasted your time in 109 at all. I think 109, people should look at it. It's a great course. They put a lot of effort into making this a course that both math majors and non-math majors can enjoy. And in reference to our earlier discussion of the Colonnade program, I think putting both those sets of students together actually benefits both sets. Having humanities majors and math majors in the same course, I think, is useful.
That would be a required course for everybody.
One of those tracks is a required course for everybody, pretty much. We have about 4,000 students a year who have to get through this somewhere or another. So I apologize for the title. I was at one point going to call it A Tale of Two Math Ways, but that was just too obscure. But anyhow. Now, these are percentages and so on, but we are talking about people. And one of the things we've done, and I give a lot of credit to our folks in institutional research, they are outstanding folks. They understand the crazy questions I ask them. They transform into real projects to do. We've been doing this for about a year now. We have a decision tree model that takes data on students, depending on the time you're looking at the student, either pre-enrollment or doing after the fifth week assessment or after the fall grades are in, we can make a very accurate prediction, something with a 90% prediction level, whether a student is at low, medium, or high risk, or very, very low risk at all, to continue. And we know who those students are. And we have provided lists of those students to departments, to colleges, so they can go to these students and do some intrusive advising and say, why are things not working out? These are the examples of kind of risk factors they use. We did not make these up. These are the risk factors proven to be a predictor of success, persistence, and retention. And this is just a snapshot of an example. All colleges, departments have access to this information on our institutional research website. I just highlighted one. This is the Gordon Ford College of Business. And this is a certain fraction of students in the green category, in the baccalaureate level, in the low-risk category, and then moderate, high, very high, and not enrolled. And it's a click on these bars, they can see lists of students and the reasons why they were placed in that category. Perhaps they were academic, perhaps they were financial, perhaps there were other reasons as well. And then faculty, the staff, know what to do to address the needs of those particular students. Again, it's stressed. 5 out of 6 students who do not return do so for reasons not connected to academic performance. Only but 1 out of 6 students fail to return because of academic deficiencies. There are many, many reasons students do not persist, and we have to, meet with those students and address those concerns. So we are intervening, and it's yielding results. I'm going to pass these around. I'm going to ask Brian to pass these around. We did this at Master Plan this year, and we did it at Freshman Convocation. And a little card we gave all the students, and it has 2 sides to it, emphasizing that this is a kind of a two-way contract between the student and the university. The student commits to doing certain things, and we in turn commit to providing opportunities, experiences, advising, and so forth in return. We had nearly 1,400 students sign. We had signature sheets for them to sign. They all signed a big banner, huge banner, you may have seen it, with their commitment to commencement. They were here to earn a degree, and they were going to commit to their side of the bargain, and we were going to commit to ours. The retention rate for those who made the commitment is 6 percentage points higher than those who did not participate in this commitment to commencement. This is sending the message. You have heard of MapWorks. This is a software program that students fill out a survey. It asks them questions about their daily life, what they're doing, how they're feeling, and so forth. Again, these non-academic reasons. Housing and Residence Life were very active in this. They gave some very significant prizes away as a sort of raffle for participating. Had a huge response rate for any survey of this nature, about 70% compared to 55%, which is still a very healthy response for the campus overall. And 78% of residential students identified as high risk, according to the survey, were nevertheless retained. We knew who they were, and we could intervene. Now, the retention rate for high and very high risk students who were contacted was 20 percentage points higher than those who we couldn't contact for whatever reason. So we're going to continue these efforts. We believe they're critical to progress in persistence and retention. We are projecting modest gains in that number already. The black line here shows the fall to spring retention rate. That shows that 10% of students simply don't even return for a second semester. This is the 72-73% number I showed earlier. It's been fluctuating for years and is the fall to fall freshman to sophomore retention rate. Now, intermediate between these two is, of course, the spring to fall rate, the second to third semester, if you like. And that's the graph I'm showing here. This is for students who were here in the spring of their freshman year, what fraction return for a sophomore year, and we're already seeing an increase in that by just over 1 percentage point. And 1 percentage point, as you'll see in us shortly, is a very significant number. There are two key elements I keep stressing here. One is persistence, keeping students from the freshman to the sophomore to the junior year, and then ensuring that they graduate in a timely manner. This is the persistence rate from 100%. Here's that 72% persistence in the first year. About 90% of those, so now we're down to about 65% second year and so on. And so we end up with a situation where we have about 55% of our students still enrolled in year six, but only 49.5% have actually graduated. That's this 5.5% gap that I want to talk about, the not yet graduated group. We have begun taking steps to increase the percentage of students who are still here to encourage them to graduate on time. We have a cohort tracker for each cohort of students. We track those students through years one through six to see how many have graduated, how many are still enrolled but not yet graduated, how many folks are not enrolled for whatever reason. We share that information with departments. It's been wonderful. Oh, I got an email from Danita Kelly, the Associate Dean of CHHS, about a week ago saying, okay, here's the story. We had about 35 students in our list, and guess what? Over 20 are now going to be graduates because we put them into summer courses. We did this, we did that. I'll share a number with you here. If you take our 2004 cohort and apply the yield rates that were actually true for that cohort through the 2010 graduation year, and that's the percentages, the 72% and so on, all the way through to year six. If you applied that to our 2008 cohort, and that's the students who have to graduate by 2014 to be counted, and that's the cohort that CPE is looking at for its strategic agenda and on which it will base performance, funding, measures, and so forth. If we continue with that 2008 cohort the way we continued with our 2004 cohort, we will be short 26 students. That's all. That's less than one student per department. So this is very much a personal involvement game. This is not a huge problem. It involves finding single students and encouraging them to complete that degree in 6 years or less. Part of college is doing this. We're currently looking at policies. We're the only university in Kentucky right now that does not allow students to pursue two baccalaureate degrees concurrently. You have to earn one, then earn another one. And any courses you took during the first one don't count toward the second one. And I'm not sure why we do that. Because we have a student, anecdotally, with over 200 hours completed, with a very healthy grade point average, that has not yet graduated and will not graduate in 6 years, but is doing just fine. Because that student is a double major with two very, very significant majors, and it just takes a long time. And because we don't allow the earning of the first degree followed by the earning of a second baccalaureate degree, we do, but we don't start counting courses the second back until the first one is over, students in double majors are sometimes delayed even though they have earned the right to be called graduates. How many students are involved? 17 for this year. But we're only chasing, at a minimum, 26 students. All these issues, I believe, are key. So the initiative of what I'm talking about, which is following up with these folks in their fifth and sixth years and saying, can you graduate into, can we help you complete this degree before the end of the sixth year? It's to your benefit, it's to our benefit, is already working. We've reduced this 5.65% by over 1 percentage point in the first year alone. And that takes us, all by itself, gets us to our CPE target. Because we're at 49.5 and our CPE target is 50.5. So just this alone, and we have a long way to go with this. We have easily 2 more percentage points, I think, we can close this gap and have most of those folks who are still here considered graduates by the end of the sixth year. But we're not going to stop at that. We have to work very hard at the retention of changing this black line to this blue line. There's this 80% or 78%, I believe it is, target for the action plan, the 90% second to third year retention rate. And if we reach all those targets, we will have 60% of our students still enrolled at the end of the sixth year. And that will just naturally pull the green line up to this kind of purple line, and we will easily exceed our CPE target and have a graduation rate in the mid to high 50% range. 54% is our goal. Gary, you're looking...
No, and again, I remind the board that this is among the data on which we will be assessed in penetrating a higher ed funding model for performance funding.
So you're going to change so that a student can get a degree and then try to obtain a second degree, like Dr. Inslee said?
I think that's what Gordon is suggesting. Why wouldn't that student have graduated with the completion of the first degree and then gone and pursue that second degree instead of counting as a non-graduate until they complete both?
In some cases, a double major serves as a minor, so it doesn't work. In some cases, it does. There are financial aid implications as well. We may have to offer small scholarships or something to replace the financial aid that a student who's, for example, Pell eligible would lose the Pell eligibility upon graduation. They'd still be eligible for loans.
Complicated.
They could become graduate students and complete their second baccalaureate while enrolled in our School of Graduate Studies. This is just one of these interesting, I keep finding interesting anecdotes. And as we did our homework, and we're the only university in Kentucky that does not allow credits earned in pursuit of the first degree to count toward the second degree. Keeping this guy busy here.
Stay tuned. I believe that will change.
The retention task force is not resting on its laurels. They're still very, very active. But a couple of months ago, they submitted some recommendations to me. I took them to Senate because they are fairly heavily involved faculty. The Senate Academic Quality Committee reviewed them, sent us comments. We changed them somewhat. And these are the things we're moving forward with this fall. And he said, this is very much people, you know. We're requiring students to meet with their academic advisor each semester to graduation. We were not doing that. We were requiring them to meet with their academic advisor until they had reached 90 hours. And if you remember the chart, that's just where they get to the point where they should be graduating, and for some reason they're not. But we figure, well, you're seniors now, you figure this out. No. So we are requiring students to meet with their academic advisor each semester until they actually get that diploma. We're requiring students to declare a major prior to junior status. Now, some students may not quite know what major they want and so on, but studies show that undeclared students, the retention rate goes from 53% to 12% if they don't declare a major. Students who declare a major are 4.5 times more likely to be retained than students who don't. And furthermore, it doesn't matter if you declare one major and then just change your mind and declare a different one. That does not affect retention. So it's not like, well, I declared a major I didn't want and has an adverse effect. Declaring a major, any major, even if it's not the one you end up graduating with, has a 4.5 time multiplier on persistence from that second to third year. So we're going to require students moving forward to declare a major prior to registering for the 60th hour, through registration holds or whatever. We are going to implement enhanced academic advisement at college department level. We recognize that academic advisement is multifaceted. It involves certainly faculty who are experts in their field and can advise students pathways to certain career goals, scholarly goals, and so on. But sometimes also involves staff who, frankly, they know the rules. They understand the process. They can help students with, you know, some of the more routine, straightforward issues associated with advising. And we've encouraged the colleges to develop models for blended staff-faculty advisement strategies. And my office, for the record, will put up whatever funding necessary if it requires hiring these advising professionals to help students, you know, through this. One of the concerns, I was a dean for 12 years, and one of my biggest issues was what I call the benign misadvisement. The well-meaning faculty member who inadvertently steers a student in the wrong direction because they give them a piece of advice that they believe to be true but turns out not to be true. And we therefore want the student's advisor to know if an advising hold has been lifted by someone other than themselves. In the past, that was simply not true. We didn't do that. And so a person other than the student's advisor was perhaps not as acquainted with the student's degree path, could in fact make advising decisions, and well-intentioned though they were, could have an adverse effect on the student. And so we now at least have a notification system where the student's advisor will know that has occurred and can check that what happened is what should have happened. Heard this earlier today, we will be next Tuesday signing our 7th joint admissions agreements with KCTCS institutions in the state. In each of these agreements, students will be enrolled in a KCTCS institution and will be concurrently enrolled as a WKU student. They will have access to WKU's advising and mentoring facilities to help a seamless transition from the community college into a 4-year degree. We will continue our targeted recruitment based on these predicted retention models. Targeted recruiting for students who, based on known evidence, are likely to succeed. And just last week, you may have heard this discussed earlier, we are going to fundamentally change the way we allocate scholarship dollars to maximize the impact of as many students as possible. We're going to have, I believe, about a 6-tiered scholarship system. Continuing scholarships for students based on academic performance while in college to try and emphasize this, you know, retention that they're here to earn a degree and we are here to help. Again, bottom line, that's the goal. We want to be at that purple line. We do that by turning the black line into the blue line, that's retention, and we do it by making sure that students who are still here after 6 years have a degree to show for it. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I would like to say that the data you presented shows very clearly that one of the things that helps us hit that retention goal is the good relationships that we were talking about yesterday between faculty and students. That, you know, sometimes it's that one-on-one that changes lives and the time to develop those, and it's so important, and I think that shows very well here.
Very thorough.
Excellent. Very good. That concludes executive. We now move to finance and budget committee.
I
I'll direct your attention to page 49. There's one personnel action that was considered by the at the committee meeting and recommended for approval. And Ann Mead is available if there are any questions or comments on it.
You threatened to go line by line, and being at the end of the agenda is a tough place to be. All the personnel actions are the same as presented at committee. If there are any questions, mostly the senior administrative officers can answer.
Are there any items under the Finance and Budget Committee matters, and this is the only one that anyone would like, wish to remove for discussion? If not, I hear a motion to approve. That's a motion by John.
Second.
Second.
All in favor? Aye.
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 Passes unanimously.
Julia, I would like for the minutes to show that I abstained from voting on action item 3.1.
Thank you.
So, Ann, 27 days into a new budget, how are we doing so far?
Okay.
So we're in the black.
No Dr. Doom there.
That concludes finance. We're into other business. Regents can each see the calendar events coming up. Mr. President, do you have any comments on a specific event?
A couple quick thoughts. You've heard me mention it before, but really I want you to put September 21 on your calendars. That's a big day for us. You've only heard me discuss this briefly, but you'll hear more and more about it between now and then. But it will be the opening of a major new exhibit in the Kentucky Museum. That's going to be a very exciting opportunity for us at 1 o'clock that afternoon, and then our President's Circle Gala at 6 p.m. that night, which will also be the culmination of our capital campaign. And then you see the committee meetings leading up to the fourth quarterly board meeting, committee meetings on September 28th, board meeting on the 26th of October, homecoming on the 20th. We are about to be underway with the new academic year, and all is in order, and we don't call them freshmen. Members of the class of 2016 will be arriving in 2 weeks.
Anything else?
3 weeks. 3 weeks. 3 weeks.
Anything else?
That's it.
Motion to adjourn?
Move to adjourn.
Second. All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So adjourned.
Thank you.